So I feel very honored to be able to speak here at this famous institute, for which I thank the organizers very much. So the title I proposed was Overview of the Theory of Spin Glasses and Its Applications to Quantum Codes. But after submission, I found it too long. So what's more, the audience is a group of experts of quantum codes. And what's more, I almost know nothing about quantum information and quantum computation except for quantum annealing, about which I'm involved a lot, recently partly due to the debates on the DVA machine, but this is not the topic of this conference. So I decided to drop the last part of the title. So it's an overview of the theory of spin glasses. But still, this is too much. Tens of thousands of papers have been published on the topic of spin glasses, so I cannot cover all of them due to the time limitation and due to the limitation of my capacity. So I narrow the scope further, my theory of spin glasses, that I can talk about, of course. But this is too much of retreat from the initial goal, so I will add something. So this is the final point I reached. So I will focus myself on the spin glass theory itself, and a little bit beyond that from my perspective. Collaborators are listed here: Koji Nemoto, Koji Takeda, Jamari Meyer, Tomohiro Sakamoto, Masayuki Ozeki, who is sitting here, and Nihat Barker and David Sherrington. I worked with those people at various stages of this work. So it's composed of four parts. The first part is part zero. It's how was I, or did the organizers motivate to let me come here? So there are two phase diagrams of the spin glass theory. The left-hand side is from the famous paper by Denis Kitaev, Randall Preskill, 2002, in which they propose to relate the error correcting code, quantum surface code, with the spin glass theory. And P is the probability that an error occurs, or in the spin glass terminology, P is the probability that a given bond is antiferromagnetic among the sea of ferromagnetic interactions. And this axis is the temperature. And those gentlemen said that this point, which is called the multicritical point in the spin glass jargon, gives the error threshold of the toric code. And recently, Andrist, Wotton, and Katz-Graber generalized their argument to the Potts gauge glass in the terminology of spin glasses, or Q-dit code in the jargon of quantum codes, and did almost the same thing. And in practice, they did a very large-scale classical Monte Carlo simulations of the Potts gauge glass to draw this phase diagram. And the main focus is about the correcting threshold, error threshold, for various Ds. D is the number of states at a given qubit or qdit. And D2 is the qubit case, and D3 is the qdit with three states, and so on and so forth. And they found those phase boundaries. And very interestingly, the error threshold here for the qubit case, and here for the D3 case, here for the D4 case, follows the so-called hashing bound very closely, almost precisely, if not exactly, numerically by extensive Monte Carlo simulations, as I said. And similar and related results were found in those people recently. And what I'm going to talk about today is to derive those results analytically without using quantum code theory or without using numerical simulations at all, purely from classical statistical mechanical viewpoint. And that's possible. So this is part zero, and part one is an introduction of the theory of spin glasses. So as you probably all know, this is a very schematic diagram to give an idea what the ferromagnetic state is. The Ising model at very low temperatures. Spins, Ising spins are pointing upwards, for instance, and this state doesn't change with time. It's very stable against the change of the time. And it's uniform in the space. Almost all spins are pointing upwards. So it's ordered in time and space. This is the ferromagnetic state or the ferromagnetic phase, as you all know. And in contrast, in the paramagnetic phase, spins are random in space and time. Random in space in the sense that the direction of the spin changes from side to side. There is essentially no correlation between sides, except for very short-range correlations. And if you focus yourself on a single side, the state of the spin changes very rapidly. So it's disordered in time and space. And the spin glass phase is characterized by the disorder in space and ordered state in time. That is, if you look at a snapshot of the spin state, then you cannot distinguish it from the snapshot of the paramagnetic phase. But the point is that this structure doesn't essentially change with time. For instance, this left uppermost spin will be pointing upward, even if you measure the same spin at a later time. So it's frozen, randomly frozen in this sense. And this state, such states have been observed experimentally. So the main goal of the theory of spin glasses is to identify the condition under which such a strange state shows up. And if such a strange state appears, then what parameters can characterize such a strange state? And it's very interesting that the spin glass theory is related to error correcting codes in the classical regime. But this aspect I will drop because of the restriction of the time. So there are two stages in understanding the theory of spin glasses. The first one is the mean field theory, infinite range interactions. And second stage is the finite dimensional problem. And mean field theory gives a very rough overview of the state. And this aspect is established completely now. So the starting Hamiltonian is written here, which is called the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model. Those two guys proposed this problem in 1977 or 4. Oh, I'm confused. So S is the Ising spins, plus or minus one, and JIJs are randomly fixed interactions with Gaussian distribution. the mean is j naught and the variance is j squared. So j naught is the center of distribution of Gaussian distribution. So if j naught is very large and j is fixed, then almost all interactions will be ferromagnetic. So up to along this line, far to this region, almost all spins will have ferromagnetic interactions. So at low temperature, there is a ferromagnetic phase. And if J naught is close to zero, then the distribution will have a peak near zero. So some spins, some interactions are ferromagnetic and others will be antiferromagnetic. So spins will feel very sort of random environment, which leads to the spin glass state, as I described before. And at low temperatures, there appears spin glass phase here. They showed, and of course, at high temperatures, there is a paramagnetic phase. Forget about this strange phase. This is essentially a ferromagnet. So they derived this phase diagram by using the so-called replica method. And the replica method is not a rigorous tool to solve the problem. And what is more, they used an approximation, so-called replica symmetric approximation, and which yielded very strange results such as negative entropy at low temperatures. And this problem was solved by Parisi several years later. And it is now established that the Parisi solution of the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model describes the exact solution of the SK model. And the Parisi picture, or the Parisi solution, is a very strange one. The other parameter is written here, which is sort of the overlap of a single spin at different times. So in the spin glass phase, as I said, the spin states are ordered in time. So if the system is in the spin glass phase, this Q alpha beta will be finite. And Parisi showed that the free energy as a function of the state of the system has a very rugged energy landscape. As you change the state of the system, the spin configuration, the free energy changes very rapidly, and the state is, and the free energy is a very rough function of the state. And not just that, if you expand this small part near the bottom of the free energy landscape, and if you expand it, then you find the same structure, essentially the same structure, not exactly, but essentially the same structure. And this hierarchical structure continues forever. If you expand this part once again, and essentially the same structure appears, and so on and so forth. So it is a very complicated, rough energy landscape. And this aspect is reflected to this, distribution function of the order parameter. Since there are many global minima in the phase space, the order parameter does not have just a single value, but it is distributed like this. And this finite width distribution of the order parameter is a very essential feature of the Parisi solution, or the mean field picture of the spin glass phase. And Parisi, Giorgio Parisi, derived this solution very intuitively by skipping rigorous arguments, but it has been proven that his solution is indeed rigorously justified by mathematical methods. So he's a genius. He just knew the answer and tried to justify his intuition by very ambiguous arguments. So this is a very brief introduction to to the mean field theory of spin glasses. And what about then finite dimensional cases? Of course, the reality is finite dimensions. Experiments are done in three dimensions. So one asks, if there is a spin glass phase in three dimensions, and if there is, then what are the properties of the spin glass phase in three dimensions or in any finite dimensions? Is it different from the mean field picture? And answers to those questions are relatively firmly established now, almost exclusively by numerical simulations, very extensive numerical simulations. And it is known that a finite temperature spin glass phase is spin glass phase exists in dimensions 3 and higher. And the properties of the finite dimensional spin glasses are similar to the mean field, very complicated state in dimensions d larger than 6. But it is simple, like a, some sort of disordered ferromagnet in dimensions 3, 4, and 5. But all these results come from numerical simulations, almost all of them. And no rigorous results or exact solutions have been established in the field of finite dimensional spin glass theory. So there are a lot to be done, but this is too hard a problem. So almost no one is working on it now. So, but there is an exception. This is the part two, in which we can establish some exact results on finite dimensional spin glasses using the gauge symmetry inherent in the spin glass Hamiltonian. So the formulation is, as before, the Hamiltonian is written like this. Si and Sj are the Ising spins, which can be generalized, but for the moment, let me concentrate on the Ising case. And Jij is the random interaction. It may be Gaussian or the plus minus J Ising model, which is defined here. Jij is either plus one, or you can choose the unit of energy appropriately so that Jij is either one or minus one with probabilities P or one minus P. This convention is the opposite from the code field. It should be one minus P here and P there, but it is just a matter of convention. They are completely equivalent, of course. And the summation runs over all pairs of interactions. For instance, nearest neighbor pairs on the square lattice or the cubic lattice. So we want to solve this problem by statistical mechanics. And we want to establish such a phase diagram. Here's the P axis, and here's the T axis, the temperature axis. If P is equal to one, then all interactions are ferromagnetic, uniform ferromagnetic. So it is the usual Ising model with uniform ferromagnetic interactions. So in dimensions 2 and higher, there is a ferromagnetic phase up to a critical point, Tc. And Tc, for instance, in two dimensions is the Onsaga point. As you know, Lars Onsaga solved this two-dimensional uniform Ising model in 1944, which started the field of phase transition and critical phenomena. And if P decreases from one, then some of the bonds are replaced by antiferromagnetic interactions. So initially, almost all spins are pointing up, but some bonds are replaced by antiferromagnetic interactions. So the state of the spin neighboring to this antiferromagnetic interaction becomes unstable. So the transition temperature decreases as P decreases from 1. And beyond some point, PC, the ferromagnetic phase ceases to exist. And it is replaced by the spin glass phase in dimensions 3 and higher. And this phase diagram is symmetric with respect to P 1/2 on bipartite lattices, such as the square lattice or the simple cubic lattice in 3 dimensions. So the goal is to draw such a phase diagram as precisely as possible. And if it turns out that there is a spin glass phase here in the middle of the phase diagram at low temperatures, then to investigate the properties of the spin glass phase. And this is a very difficult problem. The two-dimensional Ising model has been solved along this line. And even on this purely ferromagnetic line, the three-dimensional case has not been solved, of course. And the addition of randomness away from P1 adds extra difficulties, of course. And this is a very difficult problem, as you can imagine. But you can solve this problem exactly if you restrict yourself to a subspace of the phase diagram, irrespective of the dimension. So let me mention the condition under which we can solve the problem exactly. You restrict yourself to this subspace of the phase diagram, which relates the ferromagnetic ground state and the P 1/2 infinite temperature limit. And this dashed red line is drawn according to this equation. Beta is the inverse temperature, and P is the probability that the state and the bond is ferromagnetic. If P is equal to 1 here, then the right-hand side is 0. And beta should be infinity, which means T 0. So the line starts from here. On the other hand, if P is 1/2, the right-hand side is 1, which means beta 0 or T infinity in this limit. So apparently, this condition represents a line starting from here and ending up there. So by topology, it is clear that it should go across a phase boundary somewhere because the ferromagnetic state is stable down there. The stability of the ferromagnetic phase, not just along this line, but around here, can be established rigorously. So there should be a phase transition point along this line. And if you restrict yourself to this line, then it is possible to derive the exact expression of the internal energy. And the result is written here. You don't have to worry about the symbol here. I will explain it later. The average energy is equal to the minus NB, where NB is the number of bonds in the system. It is a trivial number. And hyperbolic tangent of beta. Beta is the inverse temperature. And this is the exact solution in 3 dimensions, 4 dimensions, 1,001 dimensions, whatever, irrespective of the large structure. So it's very mysterious. As I said, that condition involves a crossing with a phase transition point somewhere, but the energy does not have a singularity at all. But this is the exact solution. It holds in the thermodynamic limit if you divide both sides by the number of spins on. And so the referee rejected this paper. I still clearly remember what the referee said, just 2 lines. The model is artificial and the result is thin to warrant publication. The model is artificial because the temperature depends upon the probability. The result is thin, but since it is hyperbolic tangent. So I fought, it was a tough fight for a student, but I eventually had it published. So forget about it. And it is also possible to derive an upper bound for the specific key. It is not possible to derive the exact expression for other quantities than the energy itself, but it is possible to derive an upper bound for the specific heat, and the result is very simple. This is generic, once again, the number of bonds NB times the inverse 1 over hyperbolic tangent, second hyperbolic square, the beta. And of course, this quantity is finite. And it is also very peculiar because at this point, the ferromagnetic phase transition point here, the specific diverges generally, as you know, from the Onsaga solution, which shows a logarithmic divergence of the specific heat. And the same is true in three dimensions. But any phase transition along this line should have a finite value of the specific heat at the transition point. It's strange, but it's exact. And it is now established, not rigorously, but from many examples, that this point where three phases merge, ferromagnetic, paramagnetic, and spin-glass phases merge, which is the point called the multicritical point, lies on this line. And so this is a very special line. And at the multicritical point, the spin-glass and the specific does not diverge in any dimensions, on any lattice. And it can also be shown that order parameter, the spin-glass order parameter is equal to the ferromagnetic order parameter, which means that this line does not go into the spin-glass phase because the spin-glass phase has a finite Q and vanishing M, which is in contradiction with this equality. So these and other results can be established exactly. And I will show you the steps to derive this expression. It's very simple, just three-page calculation, three-page in the PowerPoint page. So just half a page. Yes, please.
Is this upper bound for the specific key usually also a good approximation, or should we just use it as an upper bound?
It's exact in one dimension, trivial. But it is not in higher dimensions. It's exact in the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model, in the infinite dimensional limit. But it's loose in finite dimensions generally. From comparison with numerical results. Oh, okay. There is another result. Yes.
What is the square bracket?
Okay. The inner brackets, triangular brackets, are the usual thermal average, statistical mechanical average using the Boltzmann weight. And the outer brackets is the average over the randomness of the interactions, JRJ, the so-called configurational average in the jargon of spin-glass theory. I will show it exactly how to express it. And there is another result which is very relevant to quantum codes. That is the multicritical point. Below this multicritical point, the ferromagnetic phase cannot extend like this. The phase boundary between the ferromagnetic phase and non-ferromagnetic phase should be either vertical or this way, which is called the reentrant phase diagram. So the leftmost point, which is the mirror reflection from the usual phase diagram you may be familiar with, so just reflect the figure in your mind. So this point gives the bound for the zero temperature critical point. This can be proven rigorously using the same argument, as I will show you now. So these are the results. And these results come from very simple methods using the gauge symmetry of the problem. So it's the proof. The proof will go 4 pages. Sorry, it was not 3. It's 4. So I will speak as slowly as possible so you, all of you can catch up. So here appears the definition of the average energy. The square, the triangular brackets is for the statistical mechanical average using the Boltzmann factor. So E average is average of the Hamiltonian over all spin configurations by the weight e to the minus beta h. And the outer brackets is the configurational average over the distribution of bonds, the value of the bonds plus one or minus one. And as I defined before, Jij is one with probability p. And Jij is minus one with probability one minus p. And those two quantities, of course, add up to one by definition. And such quantities can be expressed like this. E to the kp divided by this quantity and e to the minus kp divided by the same quantity because they add up to one. So this is the definition of e to the kp or kp. And the difference between this and that is just a sign in the exponent, in the numerator. So this probability distribution can be expressed like this. E to the kp times jij divided by this quantity. If jij is equal to one, then it gives this quantity. If jij is minus one, then it ends up with this quantity. So this factor gives p or one minus p according to the sign of jij. And each bond, the probability of each bond is independent from that of other bonds. So this probability should be multiplied over all bonds, Jij. So, and we should sum up of all possible configurations of the signs of bonds. So this is the probability that a given bond configuration shows up. And this quantity, this expression, is the definition of the outer square brackets. So this is the quantity to be calculated, which is a very difficult task in general. So I did nothing. I just wrote the definition of the average to be calculated. So what do? Just rewrite the definition, and you will naturally be derived to the final expression, hyperbolic tangent beta, by the following argument. So I once again write the definition here. As you see, let me go back to there. The numerator here is just the derivative of the denominator with respect to minus beta, because h by the derivative of the numerator with respect to minus beta, h comes in front of the Boltzmann factor. So this is the definition. And since this is the product of all ij's, and denominator does not depend upon ij, so this product just gives this power n, nb. Nb is the number of factors appearing in this product. And the product of exponential is, of course, the exponential of the sum. So it is still just another expression of the definition of the average energy. So here comes something new. I apply a gauge transformation to the spin and interaction variables. I introduce another set of Ising spins, sigma I, which may be either one or minus one. and multiply spin variables by sigma I and the bond variable by sigma I, sigma j at all sides and at all bounds. This is just a redefinition of the spin variable and the interaction variable. Of course, after this change of the definition, Si is either 1 or minus 1, and Jij has the same property. I'm just redefining the name of the variables here. And I will, anyway, take the summation of all possible values of Jij and Sij. The summation doesn't change. The result doesn't change by the redefinition of the variables. And this is the essential part. This Hamiltonian is gauge invariant in the sense that after the gauge transformation, it remains the same because sigma I shows up here and there, and square of sigma I is 1. And the same is true for sigma j. So this spin-glass Hamiltonian is gauge invariant in this sense. So I start from this definition of the average of the energy. I apply this gauge transformation, and almost nothing changes in this expression, except for this part. This is invariant. This is invariant. This is invariant. And this, just this term acquires a new factor, sigma I, sigma j. But of course, this is just redefinition of the summation, and the new expression is exactly equal to the old expression. I have done nothing except for the redefinition of the variables. Very trivial. But this has an explicit dependence, superficial explicit dependence upon sigma I, sigma j. But this is superficial in the sense that it doesn't depend upon the choice of concrete values of sigma I and sigma j and so forth, so forth. So it is possible to sum this expression over all possible values of sigma I, sigma j, and sum up over the terms appearing in that choice of sigmas, because all those terms have the same value. So I sum up over all possible values of sigmas and divide the result by the number of terms in the summation of the sigma. And you notice that now appears the partition function of the same system with the effective inverse temperature Kp here. So the partition function appears here and there, and they cancel each other if Kp is equal to beta. And this partition function in the denominator is the source of difficulty of calculations, but it disappears if Kp is equal to beta. This is the condition that I wrote at the first of my part two. So under this condition, the problem greatly simplifies, enormously simplifies this way. So we are just left with this factor here and the numerator here. And this factor is, of course, independent upon Jij, so it can be pulled out of the summation symbol. And we are still talking about a finite side system, so it is possible to exchange the order of derivatives and summations. So this derivative can be pulled out of the summation, and the partition function can be written explicitly like this. And you may think that we still have to calculate the partition function, but by changing the order of summation over S's and J's, then the things becomes trivial. Because after the summation of sigmas, this factor becomes trivial, irrespective of the spin configuration. If sigma, if Si, the product Si Sj is equal to 1, then the summation over Jij will be e to the beta plus e to the minus beta. If Si Sj is equal to minus 1, then the summation will be e to the minus beta plus e to the beta. Both of these give the same result, of course. So by carrying out the summation over Jij first, the spin variables disappear completely. So this summation over S is run in vain to be canceled out with this prefactor, which leaves us with a trivial factor hyperbolic tangent. So as you saw, I just used the gauge symmetry, nothing else. No gauge, no structure of the lattice, or I didn't use any properties specific to a given dimension. So this is the exact solution for any dimension. Three-dimensional Ising model can be solved this way. So half of the talk has been done. I'm going too fast. So part three. And same argument using the gauge symmetry and just redefinition of the variables applies to any other quantities, but only the internal energy has this very mysterious property that can be, that allows us to calculate the quantity explicitly. Yes?
Can you go back to this? I just missed something trivial at the end. NB, the number of bonds, looks like it appears in the exponential.
Oh, yes. You take the derivative, and NB comes in front of it. This factor is cosh to the NB. And NB comes in front of everything by the derivative. And you are, OK, let me write it on. This factor gives cosh NB, cosh to the NB, and this cosh to the NB minus 1 times sinh, which gives the hyperbolic tangent. So similar arguments apply to other quantities, but only the internal energy allows us to go to the end of the calculation explicitly. So the argument that I developed so far is strong and weak simultaneously, quantum superposition of two states. It's strong in the sense that it is very generic. It applies to any lattice in any dimension. It's weak in the sense that it doesn't take into account the specific structure of a given lattice, for instance, two-dimensional lattice or three-dimensional lattice. It doesn't give any clue to the location of the critical point, for instance, critical properties specific to the given lattice. So the next question is, can we say anything that is relevant to a given specific lattice? The answer is yes, to some extent, which is the part three of my talk. And I will develop an argument that will predict the location of the multi-critical point in two dimensions on the square lattice. And the result agrees with the Hashing bound. Incidentally, or not, that I don't know. So the argument is the duality and the replica method. The replica part I may skip to save time. And the duality argument in two dimension, in the two-dimensional ferromagnetic Ising model has been known for years, even before the Onsaga solution. The answer is written here, as I announced before. And I can predict the location of this critical point, multi-critical point PC, by the argument that I will show you now. And the result is written here. And then numerically, the numerical value of this of the solution of this equation is written here, 0.889972, or by symmetry, 0.110028. And these two quantities add up to one by the symmetry of this expression. And as many of you may know, this expression analytically coincides with the hashing bound of quantum codes. I don't know why. And we derive this result without knowing this aspect of the theory. And I will show you how to derive this expression from the statistical mechanical point of view. Oh, and similar argument applies to the Potts gauge glass, which is a Q-dit case in terms of quantum codes. So the Hamiltonian is here. Now, Si takes on Q values from 0 to Q minus 1. And the interaction between two sites, I and J, is represented like this. If J or J is equal to 0, the interaction is minus 1 when two spins, Si and Sj, take the same value. This is the Kronecker delta, and it is 0 otherwise. And this ferromagnetic Potts model, which does not have J or J, is generalized to include J or J. And J or J is either equal to 0 or other values with those probabilities, 1 minus p and p divided by q minus 1. And the duality argument gives this prediction for the location of this multi-critical point. For instance, if q is equal to 3, the numerical solution to this expression gives this value, 0.159476, and which agrees with the hashing bound with the Q-dit code. Yes? Yeah?
Roughly 10 more minutes.
10 more minutes. OK. Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, yes. I thought I had time until 12 o'clock, so. So the same can be applied to the Gaussian distribution, but I will skip 10 more minutes. So now I have to skip a lot. I'm sorry.
Look, if you have to go over.
Well, okay. So I will skip most of the introduction to the duality argument, but it is just an exchange of the temperature variable from the low temperature side to the high temperature side. And it can be shown that the partition function of the pure ferromagnetic Ising model in the square lattice satisfies this relation. The partition function at inverse temperature, K is essentially the inverse temperature because J is taken to be one. The partition function at the finite temperature, finite inverse temperature K, is exactly equal to the same partition function of the same lattice and the square lattice by another temperature, K tilde, which is a monotonically decreasing function of the original temperature. So if temperature T increases from 0 to infinity like this, then the dual temperature T tilde will decrease from infinity to 0. So if you take the logarithm of this expression, you will have this expression relation for the free energy. Free energy at, for instance, high temperature is essentially equal to the free energy at low temperature. So the free energy at this temperature is equal to the free energy at that temperature. So if there is a singular point along this temperature line, then it should be at the point where T is equal to T tilde. Otherwise, the singularity will be reflected to the singularity over there, another point, which means two singularities along the temperature axis, which is contradiction. So if there is a unique singularity, then it should be the fixed point or the invariant subspace of the duality transformation. And the duality transformation is written in a very simple form, which gives the exact solution of the temperature, transient temperature. So this is the argument developed by Kramers and Wanya in 1941, before the solution of Onsaga. And essentially, this argument can be generalized to the random case that we found by using the replic method, which allows us to erase the randomness out of the surface. But I will skip it. And so this is the result. Some quantity called alpha is related to alpha tilde. This is a generalization of T, K, and K tilde. And the transition point should be an invariant subspace of this transformation from alpha to alpha tilde. And which gives this expression for the invariant subspace or the conjectured transition point of the spin-glass problem. And by taking the so-called zero replica limit, which is a trick used in the replica method, I give the expression that I wrote before. So I skipped a lot, but since I should leave at least 5 minutes for discussions, I temporarily summarize my talk. I reviewed the spin-glass theory from the mean field perspective as well as from the finite dimensional perspective. And mean field theory has a very complicated structure of the spin-glass phase. And in finite dimensions, it is known that spin-glass phase exists, but it is unlikely that the complicated spin-glass phase is realized in three dimensions. And the gauge symmetry allows us to derive the exact solution for the internal energy in any dimension on any lattice. And similar results can be established for other quantities. And the duality argument allows us to predict the very precise location of the multicritical point. And this, first, we thought that this was the exact solution for the location of the multicritical point, but it is now known that it is very accurate, but not exact. And Masayuki Ozeki invented an idea to improve the result further. So look at his poster. Thank you very much for your attention.
You went through that last bit like really fast. So the Potts model duality mapping, is that like known for a long time, or is this a new? So you're talking about duality mappings.
Yeah.
That's the. Is this a new result of the Potts model?
This is old.
This is old.
Okay. This is old. it's written in our 2002 paper, actually.
Oh, okay.
Where was the reference? I don't remember. Oh, it's written in this paper already.
Oh, cool. Thank
you. Yeah. No one noticed it. But I noticed it by reading the paper by Andriessen, Uten, and Katzgraber. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the status of an analytic proof of the reentrant behavior of this model?
You want to explain how this emerges from this inequality?
Has anybody proven a strict inequality there?
Yeah. This is very strict.
Analytically. So there's numerical evidence for this, certainly, but I was just wondering what the.
What can be said from this inequality is it's either straight, vertical, or reentrant, mm-hmm. nothing more.
Mm-hmm.
And the numerical evidence is that it's reentrant.
Mm-hmm. And my question is, what is the analytic situation of proving that?
I still think that there is a possibility that it's vertical, but well, it is not rigorous. And I haven't made any progress in that respect beyond this inequality.
But there's plenty of numerical evidence.
Plenty, yeah. Numerical, but numerical. It is not a proof rigorous. No, rigorous. I'm interested in rigorous proof. Yeah.
So the conclusion that the multi-critical point is not exactly at the subdual point means there are two multi-critical points, one on either side of the subdual point? In other words,
two multi-critical points on a single line, you know?
Well, you said that the along the Nishimori line, the self-dual point is not the precise location of the multi-critical point, but then the actual multi-critical point is by duality to another point where there's a second.
I get your question, but I'm trying to figure out what to be said. Probably no, but there should be an argument for it, of course. Well, the point is that in the random case, there are many multiple variables. In the case of the pure model, fixed point is a unique singularity, but the space is multidimensional. So there is an invariant surface, and this point may correspond to that. So there can be two singularities in the surface, but they may not be the same. And I just projected this picture onto a one-dimensional space and identified that fixed point. So there is a difference between this and that. This may be the explanation. Yeah.
So in principle, we know that it's possible to have the transition happening at P that is higher than the hashing bound. I mean, if you flip the diagram, or lower if you look on this diagram. So I'm curious, like, what would we need to break in your proof? So like this, your proof gives the hashing bound for anything in two dimensions?
This is not proof. This is not proof. This is an argument.
Right.
The duality part is an argument.
The replica method.
The replica method, which part is not rigorous is not very clear, but at least the replica method is not rigorous mathematical tool,
okay,
but exactly in the physicist sense.
Yeah, but let's divide that. But so the question is like, what would we need to change in the model to go beyond the hashing bound? I mean, does the argument apply to any code in two dimensions? Does it apply to higher dimensions as well?
Like, high dimensions, I don't know. In three dimensions, the lattice structure does not allow us to a self-dual argument. In four dimensions, the random gauge model is self-dual, but it is not directly related with the codes, quantum codes. So to generalize the argument, I don't know.
In 2D, do you need bipartite lattice?
Yes.
Okay, so it doesn't apply to every lattice.
It applies to a pair of mutually dual lattices, such as the triangular and the hexagonal lattice. And it gives a relation between these two multi-critical points for two different lattices. Yes.
You don't have order parameter?
Yeah.
In CD, like a model, for example, you might not have order parameters. This last statement cannot even be formal. If you don't have local
or the parameter in three dimensions, yeah, it just says that in 3D there should be a Spinglass phase from numerical results, but this line goes away from the Spinglass phase.
I know, but I mean you're talking about order parameter.
Yeah.
Local order parameter, but there might not exist
any
local order parameter.
The local order parameter exists always. But
it might not exist. You might need to use the relationship.
Zeta gauge theory, yeah, that's right. This is just this two-body spin system result. Yes.